I had invested passively in 5 commercial deals. I started telling people about what I was doing and all of a sudden discovered that there's a huge community out there that also was like me, non-accredited investor at the time, and looking for opportunities to invest in things passively.
Welcome to the Action Academy Podcast.
Stand back while I celebrate freedom.
The show where we help you achieve financial independence with the mindsets, methods, and actionable steps from guests who've already earned their freedom.
The flags of freedom fly.
Choose to do what you want.
What you want.
With who you want.
With who you want.
When you want.
When you want.
With another episode today. Now, here's your host, Brian Lubin.
Cliff Luber, what's going on, buddy?
Hey, Brian, good to be here. And I'm doing great. Thanks for asking. How about yourself?
I'm doing great, man. I'm over here chilling in Brazil. Are you still traveling around or are you back stateside?
No, stateside now. Live in Northern Virginia now as I transitioned out of the Navy. So was deployed earlier this year to Europe. Yeah, but back in the States, back in America, it's good to be home.
It's been cool watching your journey. You and I have been personal friends for, I think, going on 2 years now.
I think so.
Holy crap, man. Longer. It's been a wild ride. And you have a bunch of different pokes at a bunch of different fires. And I'm excited to get into how you've built everything up and how you layer and organize and vertically integrate all your different companies.
Yeah, I guess to introduce myself to your listeners, my name is Cliff Luber. I grew up in Missouri originally. My go-to icebreaker fun fact is my hometown is the setting for the show Ozark on Netflix. So grew up on that lake and then went to the Naval Academy for college. And then as a part of that, you have to go on active duty for a while. And I'm finishing up 8 years on active duty now, a little over 8 years, and transitioning out of the Navy right now. Got into real estate though back in 2019, and I just caught the bug talking to lots of different other sailors and other people in the military community who were investing in real estate as a hobby, or at least buying houses at every duty station. Because one of the cool things about the Navy or the military in general, and it definitely has its negative aspects too, is we move every 2 to 3 years, maybe earlier. Sometimes maybe you get to stay a little longer. So that kind of can lend itself to stacking up investment properties from your primary residences as you go. It's a slow process, but it can be sure. And you could look at the end of a 20-year career and have maybe 10 houses from where you've lived previously, which can be cool. So I'd heard of a lot of people doing that and then realized there was this huge military, commercial real estate, residential real estate investing community. Joined a couple of mastermind groups within those communities and really dove in hard in 2019. And then once COVID broke out in 2020, really doubled down with a lot of the additional free time I had. I started by buying a house in DC. I was so scared to buy a single family house that I got it with a buddy of mine and we split it 50-50, split the down payment, split the cash flow, split the responsibilities. Because after 5 years having graduated college and talking to these people who bought properties where they live, I just didn't have the courage to do it myself. And so it was just like, hey, I'll just tiptoe a little bit and do it with a partnership. And I've leveraged partnerships a lot. And then I started as an LP in apartment deals and then eventually started syndicating them as a GP, particularly the last 18 months have closed on 11 commercial properties, whether they're RV parks, a lot of multifamily, and a couple of commercial like office space, short-term rental, hospitality type stuff. So I've ventured into a few different things, but I think the ultimate theme of what I have realized personally, I really like doing, and that's investing. And I'm not saying that by, oh, I'm a really great investor, you should follow me, but I think it's something I'm just very interested in, right? Like the last several years, real estate aside, I love talking about picking stocks, talking about investment strategies, about diversifying portfolios. You only have a few things to invest. Maybe it's your money. You talk a lot about your time. It's almost a cliche in entrepreneurship circles now to say that your time is the greatest currency that you have. There were some times in the Navy where I was on my submarine or on my ship on deployment. And one of the currencies we had was sleep because we would only get a little bit of sleep. And if you like took sleep from someone else, like you were taking a currency from them. So I just like the idea of investing whatever currency you do have in either yourself or other people or in the community. And I think that's how I kind of approach. You talk a lot about adding value. And I read one of your newsletters recently talked about what do you see your 8-figure self being like? Like for me, I would take that a step further and say, what value am I providing to others? Or what problems am I investing in to try and fix with whether it's my money or with my time or with starting a company to try and fix it? That is going to propel me to be an 8-figure individual, right? So that's how I approach it a little bit.
I want to dive into each one of these businesses, the origin story of all of them. But first, I want to pick apart that quote that you just said about the 8-figure thing to where you're now shifting your kind of identity from that of investor to that of business owner and creating these funds, creating these companies, and then going from I do it to we do it. I'm curious about the perspective shifts and identity shifts that you've gone through, going from military to investor to business owner. And then I want to dissect the businesses.
Yeah, totally, man. Yeah, lots of identity shifts. There are some similarities, I would say. As I get out of the Navy, I am not trying to be a full-time entrepreneur. I'm actually applying for W-2 jobs right now. And so I actually, for now, at this point in my life, want to be a part-time entrepreneur. So I am regularly right now in Zoom interviews telling people a little bit more about me, but also explaining how I think my military experience could translate. But as it relates to entrepreneurship, I think the military usually has no-fail missions, right? Whether even if it's something that's not combat related, there might not even be lives on the line. The mindset that the military has is like, hey, this needs to get done, or it needs to be done right because the ship is trying to leave tomorrow just to go out for a training underway. When we go out to sea, we call it underway. And that is seen as no fail, even though no one's going to die if the ship leaves a couple hours later because something's not done. It's still a no fail. And I think that type of mindset is really helpful when it comes to entrepreneurship. I think a downside from having been in the military is a lot of times you don't have the ability to grow your team. Like I showed up to my submarine, I had 16 sailors that I was in charge of, and that was the team I got. You show up and you have that team. There's no really, oh, hey, Navy, I want to go ahead and add a couple sailors because I think there'd be some good ways for us to add value. Talent. They'd be like, okay, well, you need to write Congress and tell them to fund, provide more government money. So that way they can recruit more people in the Navy. And maybe 4 fiscal years later, your division can get a little bit bigger. By that time, I'm already gone and off the submarine. So there's not a whole lot, I wouldn't say creativity, but like the ability to make your own team and build a team. And so building teams and companies is something that's totally new. And there are a couple of one-off opportunities, but I think the reason I found so many veterans and active duty military people in these commercial real estate spaces and even in the entrepreneurship circles that you and I run in is because I think they are craving a way to build their own team, but to actually work towards having more income, work towards having more freedom of your time. Because in the military, there really isn't that option with maybe just a few one-off exceptions. But for the most part, the rule is you won't get more money for doing really good work and you won't really get to build the team. And your creativity is usually just part of the bureaucracy. And so it gets stunted. So being able to break outside of that is new to me, but it's very exciting and something that I'm looking forward to doing moving forward.
So as you're just now learning these lessons about hiring, managing people, building team right now outside of active duty military life, what are some key lessons that you're taking away right now in your current stage of the journey?
Yeah. So I think you have to figure out what your particular mission is and that mission statement, let's say, right? Not military proverbial mission. Just figure out what your mission is and be able to stick to that across with whatever your businesses are doing. And so for me, like I mentioned, I'd started as an LP in apartment deals. I was looking really hard to find something to invest some money that I had saved up on a deployment. And I wanted to invest that money in something. And I had heard one of my buddy's dad's friends or someone I've never met was like, oh yeah, they invested in a private equity fund that bought Yeti when it was a know-nothing company, turned it around and it built this huge brand. And they got like a 70x return on their money in a couple of years. And I was like, okay, how do I invest in something like that? And then I was like, okay. And then I realized you got to be accredited. Then you probably have to have $500,000 for a minimum investment, if not more, maybe a little less, but less is like 250,000, which is still very hard to come by, especially for a passive investment opportunity. And so I was like, okay, that's not possible. So I'm going to rule out the hedge funds, the VC funds, the private equity funds, and then discovered syndication by being like, okay, what can someone who's not accredited invest in? Then I found syndications. And then I pivoted as a general partner by leveraging the fact that I had invested passively in 5 commercial deals. I started telling people about what I was doing and all of a sudden discovered that there's a huge community out there that also was like me, non-accredited investor at the time, and looking for opportunities to invest in things passively. And you talk a lot about adding value, entrepreneurship circles all do as well. Like my value add to people was being able to provide those investment opportunities. And so that's what I've done on the 11 commercial deals and then the fund that I'm raising money for right now as well. And so the adding value piece, yes, again, it's another cliche. But for me, I realized that my mission was to make real estate investing more accessible because that's what I was doing by emailing my network, which is mainly military people. They're, you know, dual income, no kids at best financially, right? They're probably 30, mm-hmm. They're going to get an MBA and maybe late 20s or mid 30s. And then maybe their parents. I have a lot of my friends, parents who I've met over the years who chose to invest in my deals as well. And so I realized, okay, my mission is to help make real estate investing more accessible. And that's what I've done with our short-term rental management company, because it's very hard usually to learn the ins and outs of a short-term rental. It's possible to learn, but there are a lot of people out there who want to own a short-term rental, but also still have a manager. And particularly we felt like for real estate investors who know enough that like they're smart enough to pick apart a statement every month, knowing how a property should perform. And then also they're competent enough to know that, hey, I should be doing a little bit better, but they also still want a management company that's going to do right by them and do a good job. And so we wanted to provide that through Serenity Stays. And then I've pivoted from multifamily to RV parks recently as well, just because the market shifts have been so tough. And you've had a lot of episodes talking about the market, and I'm sure you will in the future, because it doesn't seem like things are going to go totally back to normal anytime soon. But I had to pivot within the framework of, hey, what's my mission? Which that is to make real estate investing more accessible. And so that's why I pivoted to RV parks, because they're an asset class that hasn't been picked over as much as multifamily. And you're able to still buy properties that will still cash flow and still appreciate and still have good value add plans without having to totally jack up rents and still be able to provide the projected returns for investors that I'm craving to provide them, because my mission is to help make it more accessible and provide returns to them.
Yeah, I love that you say that, because a quote that keeps getting brought up is that in content and in the entrepreneurial space in general, everyone talks about the average millionaire has 7 streams of income, and like in 7 sources of income. And this is true, but I think it's like, this is not a direct correlate, because what happens is people assume that these entrepreneurs build all 7 streams of income simultaneously. And then, so I think when people are starting out, that's what they try to do, is be like, okay, I need to be doing Airbnbs, flips, wholesaling, laundromats, Turo. I need to do right. all these things to build my 7 streams of income. Because if I don't build my 7 streams of income, how will I ever be a millionaire? But the way that you went about it, and the way that I think is the correct way to go about it, is you treat it like a food court almost, to where you go sample something and then you're like, okay, like I'm gonna stick with the Chinese chicken real quick over here. Right. I'm gonna hang out here. And then you're like, okay, cool. I get the chicken. I get how they make it. Now I'm gonna go over to this next place. And this place has got a barbecue place. I want to try this now. And you go from one, and then you stack, and then you stack, and then you stack. I think that's a better way to do it, is one at a time. So going back, let's go on a timeline here about how you stack these different skills and stack these different vertically integrated businesses. And I want to start with where you started with the LP investments into the syndications with the real estate. So when you're talking about being a non-accredited investor and investing in these funds, correct me, is it the 506C or the 506B that is open for non-accredited? And talk a little bit about that for people that are listening that may be interested in this, but not quite sure about what funds they're able to invest in.
Sure, yeah. Rule of thumb is a 506B is a syndication structure that you're only able to invest in if you are an accredited investor, or you're allowed to invest in it as a non-accredited investor, meaning you have a net worth of less than $1 million, if you have a relationship with the operator before they start the capital raise. So that means you got to pick up the phone and network with operators, which is exactly what I did back in late 2019. Started meeting people who were syndicating deals, got on their investor list, vetted maybe 25, 30 deals, and then invested in 5 of them over the next like 9 months. So that made me eligible for 506B, as I was not accredited. Now a 506C, or actually one more thing about 506B, the operator is not allowed to publicize that they're raising money for it. So they can email people that they already have a relationship with, but they can't go on the Action Academy podcast and be like, Hey, Brian, I'm raising money for a 506B apartment deal in Atlanta.
But we can
like,
now, damn it. But we
huge,
can now.
Yeah, huge no. And Brian's saying we can now because a 506C is totally allowed to be promoted. You can do Instagram ads, Facebook ads, whatever. You can post about it on LinkedIn for a 506C, but you're only allowed to have capital from accredited investors. So people with a net worth of $1 million or more. And there's also an income requirement as well, where you might be able to make it if you don't have a net worth of $1 million. So yeah, that's the accessibility piece. I think one thing too, I want to go back. You mentioned kind of the food court sampling thing. I didn't really realize this until you said it, but like, I really have tried a lot of different things. And like, I've done a couple of BRRRs. I've done a couple of private lending deals, both as the person lending the money and also as the receiver for those BRRRR deals that I mentioned. I haven't done a flip necessarily, but looked at office space, looked at storage for a while. Like, I did dabble a little bit and then decided to pivot to RV parks, just because I realized that was, I think, the best asset class that would help provide returns for investors. And I think it's very hard to bring new investors in at a time when it's top of the market. Sellers are still a little too cocky about the assets that they think they own should be worth millions of dollars more than they really are worth, especially with what interest rates are at here at the end of 2022. So, you know, that's why I had to do a smart pivot, but being able to try a few other things allowed me to do that. And there are things that are very similar. A lot of the transactions are the same as far as due diligence goes. And then also the idea of working with partners is huge. And I wouldn't be anywhere. In fact, I don't think I own anything by myself besides my primary residence in Norfolk, Virginia that I bought last year. Besides that, everything else is owned with a partner. So we're talking like 6 residential properties, single family homes, and then 11 commercial deals. Like none of those are owned by just me except for one of the houses. And so I have done everything through partnerships. So being able to work with other people, find out what their skill set is, see where I can best plug in and help, whether it's raising capital, doing investor relations, maybe helping source the deal, maybe helping do some underwriting, maybe helping take calls during the day, during my lunch break, when someone else is living in a different time zone than me, whatever it might be, just trying to add value in those partnerships. And that's, I think, what can allow you to succeed in whichever asset class you do choose. But if you pivot to a different one, those principles regarding partnerships are going to stay the same.
Ben Graham and a lot of people are famous for doing what's called inversion thinking, to where they talk about all the reasons and ways that we shouldn't do things so that we can focus on those just as much as the ways that we should do things. So an example of this, it'd be like, okay, here's all the examples of a business that'd be a terrible business to invest in that we would absolutely steer clear from. We don't want to be here. So I'm curious, now that you've had some experience with this and both creating and joining different teams, what is some advice that you would give to avoid having bad partnerships and having bad breakups? Because I know that there are a lot of horror stories out there, especially for people that are just starting. I think that is the biggest thing that could throw a wrench in your entire investing trajectory, is either partnering or growing a team with the wrong people. Curious about what you look out for.
Yeah, totally. I think I would definitely require dozens of touch points probably with someone before I would partner with them, unless they were vouched for by someone that I knew very well and trusted. If someone had a deal out of the blue and maybe they're in a mastermind group with me or something and reach out, I'm probably not going to join them because of kind of that, the ability or the fact that it could explode, and because it does really take a long time to build trust. And I've seen partners who've worked together for 5+ years, say break up for lack of a better term, like part ways out. And it isn't, and a lot of times I think it's amicable, but there are bad breakups as well in teams. And that can be a bit scary when you're a passive investor investing in deals with teams who are expected to work together. I would just keep it. And I think people have always said like, it's a marriage, right? When you partner with someone on a deal, because you're going to be working with them for 5 to 10 years, maybe depending on how long the hold period is. And you want to be able to account for a lot of the things that could go wrong. So I hardly saying yes to a deal unless you really know someone well, I think is smarter. I think joining a team as early as possible is also helpful. So some of the best deals that I've done and felt like I've been able to add the most value to, I was a part of the team before we found the particular asset that we bought. So I was working with them, helping get to know them better, see how they worked. And there are a couple of teams that I've joined, tried to find something. We couldn't find something, but realized I saw some things that kind of flared up during kind of a trial period, and maybe I'm just going to focus on this other team instead. So I think trial periods are big as far as one takeaway. I'd also say build your network as early as possible. Then you're never having to play catch up. Back in summer of, I went back and counted actually, because back in summer of 2020, I said, hey, I'm going to do a real estate call every day. And then ended up booking more than one a day, just because I was really trying to grow the network. And I didn't worry about, oh, maybe they don't have enough experience. Like there were people less experienced than even me, and that they didn't own any home, I would still talk to them because I knew they were up and coming in real estate, and I'm sure we could get something from each other. So I did, and I went back and counted. I did 101 calls in 60 days, just talking to people on the phone, just man. Zoom calls, phone calls, messaging people in mastermind groups, emailing people I'd heard on podcasts, whatever it might be, just getting on the phone with people. And that helps start a lot of relationships. Now, there might be people who I talked to whose names you could say, I might not even remember them. But then there are others who are some of my closest friends in the world now. And so it's, you really just have to start early building that network. And one of the questions you ask and talk a lot about on your podcast, which I really like, is if you have $5,000 start, what do you do? And I think my advice, it could be a couple of different things, but I would say use some of that at least to join a mastermind group if you already aren't a part of one, and then get to know every single person in that particular mastermind group. Because I think that really went a long way for me. For me, I joined the War Room Mastermind run by GoBro David Perret. I think you've had him on your podcast.
Yeah, I'm good buddies with him. I didn't even know about that one.
Yeah, so he started one. It's just for military members. There might be 100 people in it. Most of my partners on deals I met through that mastermind group, and it's the first mastermind group I joined. And it was awesome. It's how I met Dave. I knew him before GoBundance through that community. And yeah, it's an awesome. I met Doug Spence through there as well, and then other partners of mine who aren't in GoBundance. So networking within a mastermind group, I think, is crucial. And building that network early will help, I think, alleviate any future problems you might have in trying to vet partners quickly.
I like that. And another couple of military mastermind groups. Dave also has From Military to Millionaires, his brand. And then you have Tim Kelly and their outfit with Active Duty Passive Income. So I have an awkward knowledge of military investing now. From our friend group. I'm like, I understand everything that your guys are talking about now because I'm just in your world for some reason. And it's been fun, but it may be also beneficial to break down what different roles do you normally see in a real estate syndication so that people that are listening that may be interested in that and they know that they have some specific skill set and maybe they're a single family investor and they're sick of getting screwed by an appraisal and an appraiser that's in a bad mood one day. What does a team look like so that people that are listening to this can say, okay, Cliff said, here's the general team that makes up a syndication. Let me think about what role that I would play in that.
Yeah, totally. And that's exactly how I approached it. So the first position really is a deal sourcer slash underwriter. So you got someone who's going to find the deal and someone who's going to do the underwriting on all the deals that are coming through. The rule of thumb out there, and I think it's probably pretty true, is you might underwriter at least look at the financials quickly of 100 deals in order to find one that you'll actually close on. So it's a high volume position. It's a lot of relationships with brokers. It's a lot of leading an off-market deal sourcing opportunity if you choose to do that as well. So you got the deal sourcer slash underwriter. Then you have the asset manager. So the person who's helping ensure that the asset's actually meeting its KPIs and performing after takeover once you close on it. In between those two, there will be capital raisers. Usually everyone on a team will raise capital. There are some people who are better at it than others. For the most part, and this is not legal advice, figure this out on your own, but like for the most part, you should not and cannot join a deal and only be a capital raiser unless you have certain licenses. And I don't know what they are, so this isn't advice in that particular sense, but you cannot only raise capital. And that's not the only thing.
I didn't even know that.
Yeah. So you usually have to have a couple of different licenses or at least one in particular where you're allowed to be a broker, that broker, quote unquote, not that sources deals, but one that raises capital, like a financial broker. So I've made sure to not dabble in that aspect and made sure that I've had plenty of responsibilities with the deal sourcing, the due diligence pieces and things like that. So you've got deal sourcer slash underwriter, asset manager, capital raisers. I think the other big one, and this is the one that I've fit in most with my earlier deals, was investor relations. So someone who is listening in on the meetings, talking to the property management staff, talking to the asset manager and compiling what the important takeaways are for investors after closing. So for most of my deals, we send a monthly email to all of our investors. So you don't just sign the paperwork, you show up to the webinar, sign the paperwork, wire the funds, and never get told anything on good deals, at least. You should at least be getting monthly, if not quarterly, emails and updates from the team. And the investor relations person is usually the one kind of dealing with that and helping write those on a regular basis. So for me, I realized that was a niche that I could fit in at the beginning when I was getting started as a GP. Because I had been a limited partner on 5 deals and there were a few that did not have good communication. And that kind of frustrated me. I didn't need to hear about it every day. I didn't even need to hear about it every month, but there were months at a time where we wouldn't hear anything. And then I'd email the operator and not hear much for a few weeks. And it's like, it didn't make me feel super great. And there are a lot of, I am not the only one that had that experience. There are dozens and dozens of people who I've spoken with who've had that experience as a limited partner. So I would recommend, obviously, make sure that they fit your desires for a team that you'd invest in passively, but make sure they're going to be sending communications out to you often enough. So those are the 4 big positions. Capital raising is definitely huge. Depending on the deal size, you could raise anywhere from maybe $500,000 to $3 million for a deal, for the deals that I've done in the Midwest or even the Southeast. I found at the time in 2020, a good rule of thumb for me was, hey, if you could raise $500,000 and add value to a team through one of those other positions that I mentioned, then you would be able to get invited onto a team. So I got $500,000 in soft commits and then just started running with it. Now I'd say it might be a bit higher, but it really depends. Like with the GoBundance network that I was finding in the War Room Mastermind, a lot of people in the military real estate communities, like that's about the number that I found was valuable enough. Okay, cool. Let's bring them on board if they could raise that much capital and then add value in some other way.
Can you say more on that specifically? Because I've never heard of that. And that would be me. Like I would be the capital raiser. Like that's where I would fit in somewhere, or investor relations. So as someone that's a noob in all of this, you could speak to me like I'm a fifth grader or a golden retriever.
Okay.
All right? That's a very interesting rule. That's the first time I've ever even heard about that. Say more about that. So for people that are listening right now that may be like, okay, capital raising, like I'm that guy. Like I've got all this network. I've got all these relationships, but Cliff's telling me that I need to wear other hats in this deal. What would that look like tangibly?
Sure. Yeah. We'll need to do a part 2 episode on just this question. I think it could go on forever. So I think
interesting.
Okay. Glad to hear it. Yeah. I know. I mean, it was interesting for me to figure it out. So the position I was in 2020, when I knew I wanted to, I felt like I had enough experience to add value to a team as a general partner, but I wanted to be able to tell more people about what I was doing. So I created an email list of friends and family, and then started telling a lot of my friends where I was catching up with what I had been investing in lately, which was syndication. So I did five of them, as I mentioned, and then realized a lot of people were telling me, hey, I'd be interested. What's the minimum? How does it work? I was like, well, the minimum can vary, but it might be anywhere from 25 to 50 grand. They said, okay, put me on your list. I'd love to invest in your next deal. Or once you get a couple under your belt, come hit me up. So I just started keeping a tally of all of the soft commits that I had. And once I had about 500,000 in soft commits, it just so happened one of the 101 networking calls I did was with my buddy, Michael Barnhart, who was in the War Room Mastermind. And I've closed four deals with him since. And I joined his team within a couple of weeks. And then I told my investor list, hey, we're looking at apartments in Tulsa, Oklahoma City. Hey, we're still looking, but I've got a website now. And that was like a month later. And then, oh, hey, we got a property under contract. Let us know if you're interested. And we just kept tallying up soft commits. Now, a couple of things to keep in mind. I wouldn't do a deal if I did not believe that the projected returns were going to hit what we think for our investors. Like before we've closed on a property, the investors come first. After we close, the residents of the property come first, and then our investors second. You can't just go willy-nilly into a deal that you get invited in on and just take other people's capital very seriously, I guess is my point. And it's easy to forget about that.
I feel like it's more serious taking other people's capital than your own, at least in the circles that we run in, because we have to remind ourselves that we're in a complete bubble when it comes to GoBundance and some of the mastermind groups that you and I are both a member of. And people are like truly like good people to their core. So there are bad operators out there. It's just the people that come on this show and the environment that we're in is sheltered from that. So that's a very interesting observation, because from what I've seen, everyone that comes on the show, it's like as soon as you have other people's money, they're like, oh my God, that's when the panic attacks start in, where they're like, now I'm an even more serious steward, because I can lose $100,000 of my money and chalk it up to, okay, cool, I learned a lesson. But losing $100,000 of somebody else's money, that's just not even an option.
Yeah, 100% agree. For those listening, I was nodding at everything Brian was just saying. Yeah. Other people's money, and that's good. You're interviewing guests that explain and express the weight of it and feel that weight. Because there are a lot of people out there, I think, unfortunately don't really value it that much. And so they're just like, oh yeah, once you get OPM, then you're good. That's when you can really become successful in an eight-figure stuff. And I'm not trying to become wealthy on the backs of other people. Like, I really want to stick to that initial mission of helping make real estate more accessible. And part of making it accessible is actually delivering the returns
the value.
Project. Right. Yeah. Delivering the value, because I let people invest in it, I want them to invest again. Don't want to lose all their money or only return their capital or something like that. And yes, deals go bad. And I haven't had any, luckily, that have gone, you know, south or anything like that. But there are syndicators right now, or even within the last year or two at the end of a huge bull market, still not delivering amazing returns. There are ways for deals to not go super great. So I guess I'll say all that to say, I see doing this business as investing in community, it's the syndication business, as investing in communities by buying properties that are owned by slumlords or people who just aren't able to pay enough attention to the property anymore. And we go in and make it a community and make it more valuable. We beef up the amenities that each property has. We go in and renovate the old crappy units. We try and fix repairs as soon as they pop up and take work orders incredibly much more seriously than any previous owner. Like, we do those things to invest in the community. But then I also see syndicating as investing in your LPs. Like, yes, your LPs are investing in your deals and your properties, but I'm investing in them and I'm investing for them. And I take that really seriously. And it's a huge part of what I do. Now, I think having some track record of single family success or investing as an LP, or at least like knowing the game, is really crucial too. So I have a hard time when I hear people who've maybe never invested in a dollar in a commercial real estate deal or in a business, wanting to all of a sudden raise money from other people. But I could see, I could buy that there's an exception, but I get a little scared when every 23, 24-year-old or something wants to do that. And I would have hated to hear that when I was 3 or 4 years ago, when I was in my shoes. But I do really think you have to have been an LP first. And even if you can't afford 50 grand in a deal to be an LP, that's fine. I made a couple of my investments, which was $5,000 or $10,000, because I was talking with the operators and I was saying, hey, if you get close to the end of the capital raise and the dollar amounts don't shake out and you have enough unaccredited investor slots, let me know and I'll invest. So it's not like I put 50 grand into five different deals. I didn't have that kind of capital. I'm a naval officer after all. It's a public service, so we don't get paid. You could try and find ways to invest lower than the initial projected minimum, because the PPM, the 100 plus page legal document that actually details these investments in great detail and as detailed as it will be, will usually say a different dollar value of what the actual allowed minimum is. And chances are it's something like $5,000-$10,000. So you might be able to get in even that way. And I think even that is enough to be able to show people, hey, I have put money, put faith in other operators. I put money into other deals before. For that way, when you get more experience and you go to ask other people for money, you're at least being able to bring that kind of expertise to the table, if that makes sense.
I was absolutely about to drive that exact same point home as a takeaway from what I'm gathering, listening to you and hearing you teach on this. Because when I see this, I'm like, okay, like guy that has earned the right to raise capital. So we talk about accelerants a lot, and we talk about setting big, hairy, audacious goals and maybe starting with like larger scale properties, larger scale deals to where we're not maybe doing the single family, then a duplex, then a quad the next year, then an 8-unit. What would it look like to start out with a 60 unit, right? And we all talk about this. And I think there's a place for that in concept and theory, right? But there's a couple of different maneuvers that need to be placed before just jumping that. So maybe that 60 unit is the first deal that you take down. But to Cliff's point, I think it's a very important caveat that maybe for that first deal, there's 2 years of back work to where you were investing as an LP in other deals. You were making those 100 phone calls to brokers, to other multifamily investors, finding some way to provide value that may not be just necessarily investing in the fund, but calling the asset manager and being like, hey, can I kind of intern for you? What do you need help with in managing the property? Can I walk the property with you? I would say 9 times out of 10, if you were like, especially up to do some physical labor and stuff, they would happily walk you through. And I've done that before. I'm curious about your experience with that.
Yeah, shoot. You mentioned walking properties. I think I walked four properties that I had nothing to do with, just ones that were in the Norfolk, Virginia area where I was living, or at the time I was about to live. And one time I drove 3 hours just to go walk a property on a Saturday and came right back with an operator on a deal that I don't even think he closed it. And I knew certainly wasn't going to go be a part of it. It was too big. I hadn't, you know, done a GP deal before, didn't have enough to add value, but I went and walked the property, helped fill out inspection forms and helped look at 40 units or something like that as a part of my team's, the units that we got assigned. So I think that part is huge. Another thing too, all those things you mentioned are definitely crucial. I think investing in your education is huge too. And yeah, whether it's, there are people who will pay 25 grand to do a mastermind or a coaching program and stuff like that. I did not do that. I chose to invest in my education through some mastermind groups, which were nowhere near as expensive as a coaching program. But then I didn't have a coach. So then I had to choose what resources I was going to get. And so I read every book there was on commercial real estate, particularly apartments, and then also subscribed and listened to 400 or 500 podcast episodes from 2018 into 2020 before I really even got started to really get good at it, know what topics interested me. I listened to almost every Bigger Pockets episode, I think before Brandon Turner left, like really dove in to learn real estate as a whole, learn from other people's experiences, right? I think it's a good adage that you shouldn't make the same mistake twice, but I want to make sure that I don't make the same mistake that I've heard twice, right? Because there's enough lessons learned out there in the podcast world to totally take up your entire life just hearing those. So being able to learn from those experiences was definitely something that is free. It just takes some of your time.
Absolutely agree. And I would add the one caveat that people wait for years and years to get the confidence to take down a deal. And so they wait for these years to get the confidence to take action. But the irony is that taking the action is what builds the confidence even faster.
Yeah.
So you listened to the podcast, you did all that. I did that too. Like I was going back and forth from my sales job, just listening to real estate podcasts, getting a feel of it. But I'll tell you, like, I didn't know shit until I was in that first house hack and my basement is flooded. And I'm like, okay. I didn't know shit until I had the tenant not paying. Sure. And then you're in it. You're making those calls. You are doing these deals. You are investing as an LP. You are seeing it from all these different angles. So like you were in it. And it's the applied knowledge, I think, that is what really drives people forward, because winners and losers have the same. So right, the only difference between the two people is the one is going to commit to taking massive levels of action while the other one's going to keep prepping for it. So totally. I think you absolutely murdered it. For the sake of time, you said something about the lack of respect for other people's capital, especially when it comes to how these deals are performing. And you've also mentioned prior in this interview about how you've pivoted to parks as your vehicle for what your funds are doing. I'm curious, I just had Calvin Shin on and he was talking about how he is adjusting, how he's opening the hood of his deals and how he's doing the underwriting differently, how he's doing the debt terms differently, how he's avoiding short-term bridge debt and anything where he's going to get called in the short term. And he's actually spreading it out to 5-10 years as his horizon with his deals. I'm curious, can you talk about how your new vehicles through RV parks will differ from your previous ones and how you're organizing and situating the terms so that anybody that's investing with you knows that this is something good that they're going to be able to participate in going into this next recessionary event here at 6-12 months that we're in?
Totally. Yeah. So closed 9 apartments up until, I think the most recent one we closed was July of this year. And then over the summer, made the pivot to RV parks by partnering with Climb Capital, run by Jeremy Hands, who's a GoBro. And I'm co-sponsoring. Yeah, totally right. And I'm co-sponsoring the fund with him and helping raise capital for the fund. I'm also helping with East Coast acquisitions as well, looking for RV parks. So it's a fund we're raising $20 million, 506C fund for accredited investors only. We're raising $20 million to buy 10 to 20 resort style RV parks in the Southeast United States or the Sun Belt, with a couple of Midwestern states as well. They're falling into our buy box. Happy to chat more about it with anyone. They could just shoot me an email and that'll be in the show notes. But I think a couple of things we're doing differently. So for one, we're going to an asset class where it still works. So if you're familiar with cap rates, like we're buying RV parks right now at like a 7-10 cap rate. Whereas if you're buying an apartment, it's probably five and below, probably something in the 5 and below if you're in a good market, but 4s. And if you're buying anything in a really good market, it's like high 3s. And in theory, the higher cap rate, the better. But when you're buying, at least, so it depends. We could just do a whole episode about that too. But so we're buying assets that aren't picked over a lot because they're 70% mom and pop owned. And it is very hard for institutions to go into the space. Blackstone just announced, I think, a $50 billion fund kind of doubling down on multifamily earlier this year. We're not really having to compete with institutions yet in the RV park space, but we are planning that they will eventually come into the space more when we go to exit the fund in 5 or 7 years. So selling the portfolio to an institution is one of our exit plans. One of the things we're doing differently is by not only just pivoting to it, but also we have our own management company as well. So Climb Capital, the lead sponsors, have their own vertically integrated management company, because one of the reasons institutions can't pour into this space is because of management, because it's very easy to just Google apartment manager, Airbnb manager, like for property management, but it is very hard, if not impossible, to find an RV park management company. So Climb Capital built their own, and they've been managing RV parks for years now, as well as other asset classes. So they're not just a one-trick pony in RVs, but they cover the hardest one, which is RV park. The other reason why it's hard for institutional capital is because of the technology aspect, and just that it's very hard to get a hold of landline using phone owners who only make up 70% of who owns a mobile home park. It's all mom and pops about to retire or wanting to pass it off to their families. And so we're actually going and building relationships with these owners. We know at this point, maybe even thousands of owners, and are basically focusing on purchasing those parks once they're ready to retire, and doing some that are on market, but a lot of off market properties as well. And we're buying them as we go. So, you know, right now we have RV parks purchased as a part of the fund, and we'll buy 12 to 18 more, depending on the size of the parks, with the rest of the $20 million. And one other thing I'll mention too, one of my big passions, right, is making real estate more accessible. During the summer, we raised money from non-accredited investors first. And then that, once we finish that 60-day raise, then you can convert a fund into a 506C. So we were able to raise capital from non-accredited investors already, but now you have to be accredited to join. But I was still very proud of the fact that we took time and paused our marketing and everything in order to bring other people in to help provide them that opportunity to invest.
So say more in closing about why specifically RV parks in the Sun Belt and in the Southeast as an asset class.
You've had people on the show talk a lot about how you can only bring your expenses to zero. When it comes to personal finance, you can only bring your expenses to zero, but your income potential is infinite. I wouldn't say with RV parks, the income potential is infinite, but I think the ability to add other income is higher, particularly on the resort style RV parks that we're targeting. So the Southeast and the Sun Belt below the freezing line is just because they can have more short-term stays, more tourists traveling. It's where snowbirds go during the winter. So we can just have a higher occupancy rate and charge more for it. But the resort style RV parks, they have to have a water feature. They have to be near a metro location because people aren't going to drive from Atlanta to Yellowstone as much with gas prices being as high as they are and a pending recession coming. But they will probably drive to somewhere in the Southeast, somewhere that's just a few hour drive or half a day's drive, whatever it might be. So that's partially an answer to your question. And then I think the other aspect of why would really just be that you're probably going to be overpaying for an asset if you buy it right now. And that can still be the case with RV parks. But I think ultimately you're able to still stay really diligent in buying them. And there are dozens of ways to get extra income. So with an RV park, or sorry, with an apartment, you can maybe just do pet fees. You could charge a late fee and that's how you get some extra income. But with RV parks, you can charge for firewood. You can charge like 10 bucks a night for a rented kind of little fence that's temporary for people to put their dogs and bring them outside of the RV, but so they're not running around or have to be leashed, right? You could sell propane refills. You could sell higher quality internet than the one that comes with the nightly stay. You could charge extra for like Christmas lights that they might want to hang right around, or like the light bulb style that you put outside. So they're not just under one light bulb.
The hustle is real.
Yeah. So there, and that's the thing is people who are on vacation, who are traveling and who are seeking out these resort style things are willing to pay for those things. And so it's about capitalizing on a market that is partially tourism, it's hospitality. And that's why I think our RV parks, the kind that we're buying and the kind that we're going to be operating, are poised to do very well because they're a little bit more potential for higher income for those reasons.
I love it, man. So for any 506C accredited investors that are listening, what terms are you offering like for this deal? What's the projected IRR?
Yeah, so the projected IRR is 15 to 20%. The equity multiple is a little over 2, and it's a 5 to 7 year projected hold. We offer two investment classes. One has a preferred return. One is, we'll call it the equity. It's a preferred return of 7%. And then the upside is split after that with the general partners. Or you could do what we have as a yield class, which is no equity upside, but you get a higher preferred return of 11%.
Nice. So if anybody's looking into this or they're interested in more information, where do they find you?
Yes, they could go to upwardcapital.us and check out my website. They could also email me, cliff@upwardcapital.us. And that's just one F in Cliff. I'm also on LinkedIn, Instagram. You can hit me up.
Where all the cool kids are.
Exactly. Love it.
All right, brother, man. I appreciate you coming on. This has been an awesome masterclass on syndications, wealth generation in general. So I appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, thanks, man. I'm happy to see the podcast blowing up and doing so well. And I'm honored to be a guest. Thanks.
Thanks, buddy. With that, it's been Cliff Luber and Brian Lubin with the Action Academy Podcast, signing off.
Hey, real quick, if you're still listening to today's episode, I'm assuming you got value from it, so I need your help specifically. My 2-year vision with this show is to help over 1 million people do what they want, when they want, with who they want, and I can only do that with your help. There are two main ways that a podcast grows. One is through ratings and reviews, and the other is word of mouth. If you could please leave me a 5-star rating and a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, as well as send this to one or two friends that you think would get value from it, we can reach the people that we're looking to reach. Thanks in advance. Talk tomorrow.